I will switch to English to introduce our speaker of the day. So, Rudy, I'm very grateful to you that you accepted my invitation to come for a seminar, and it was a beautiful opportunity because you came for a thesis defense at LKB yesterday. So we did a coup double, as we say in French. I don't think Rudolf Grimm needs a very long introduction, but I'll just say a few things. Rudy is both German and Austrian, is that correct? You were born in Germany, but you now also have Austrian citizenship. You were born in a very, very good year, which I recommend particularly to be born in, which is the same as my birth year. It's also the best year for wine, for Chateau Yquem in France, but okay. You studied physics in Hanover, in Germany, and did a PhD at ETH. And then you wandered in various places. In particular, you spent some time in the then USSR, correct? In Troitsk and Moscow. And then finally, in 2000, you joined University of Innsbruck, where I read that you even have been dean at some point. Is that correct?
4 years. Yeah.
Yes. And Rudy has a number of scientific achievements to his credit, especially in the field of ultra-cold atoms. He was elected a full member of the Austrian Academy of Science in 2005, and also in 2007, a fellow of the American Physical Society. I'm not going to list all your other awards. I think we are now going to jump directly to the topic of the day. So recently, one of the beautiful achievements was done in Rudy's lab in Innsbruck, which is the observation of second sound. This followed a theoretical proposal also of the group of the BC Center in Trento. And that will be half of the topic of your talk today, if I understand correctly. The other half would be to tell us even more recent findings in your ultra-cold gas research. So thank you, Rudy, for accepting the invitation, and we're now going to listen to you.
Okay, Antoine, thanks for the introduction. The microphone is working. Yeah, okay. So thanks for the introduction. It's always a great pleasure for me and a great honor to be at Collège de France. So now it's a very nice situation that you set the stage so perfectly with a wonderful introduction into a very fascinating field. So I can really save some time and go very quickly to the introductory part. As introduced, I want to talk about the observation of second sound and some other stories. The background slide actually is some artist's kind of view of the two sound things. This is a trapped Fermi gas, superfluid, as you see, and there are two kind of waves. These ones, it's the first sound, and this one is the second sound, which is slower. This is excited by a blue laser beam here. Okay, but now let me start with showing you the periodic table. And so the question is, I mean, you know, how many of the species have been Bose condensed? Who wants to try? Christoph, you should know.
Wow.
What do you think?
12?
Almost, yeah. 13, it's a lucky number, 13, yeah. But there are much less actually Fermi gases, and you can another try how many Fermi gases?
Three.
No, that's more. It's getting closer. Okay, it's 7, another lucky number. So you see the kind of traditional species, the alkali atoms, potassium-40 and lithium-6. Lithium-6, I think, first degenerates in 2001 in Christoph's lab. And then three other species, intermediate ones, ytterbium, metastable helium, strontium, a little bit later. And then in actually last year and this year, two new species, dysprosium in the lanthanoids, and very recently erbium. And I think this gives many new opportunities. And we have in Innsbruck actually three of them. We had four of them quite recently, but strontium disappeared to Amsterdam just 2 weeks ago. And now we have three of them. And the first story actually is related to lithium-6 and the observation of second sound in lithium-6. The second story is related to the new dipolar Fermi gas of erbium. And the third story, if time is sufficient, then it's about atom dimer attraction, the few body phenomenon in mixtures of lithium and potassium. So that's the outline of my talk. Now, let me just very briefly the superfluidity. So the next slide is if you actually, so the introduction was perfect already, but if you want to catch the attention of young students and you want on superfluidity, how would you do this? I think a very good thing is you point to YouTube. There are some videos on YouTube. And actually, you find something which is quite fascinating. It's an old educational film by Alfred Leitner. Actually, he came originally from Vienna, I learned, and then had to immigrate. And he produced some educational films. And I think from the experimentalist point of view, he perfectly makes the different points that are very important in the field. I really like this.
Incidentally, I showed the Fountain Effect movie.
Yes, yes, all these movies, all these famous movies and and also pictures come from this. It's really interesting, and I find the points he made very clearly now in relation also now quite on the present experiments. It was made in 63, and so the movie number 6, so it's split into 6 parts on YouTube, is dedicated to second sound, and then you see how it's relatively easy to excite and detect second sound in liquid helium. And I mean, all these bizarre phenomena, I mean, you know this about two-fluid hydrodynamics, and just mention again Tisza 1938 with putting forward this idea of the two-fluid theory, and then Landau with his theory in 1941. Okay, now another very simple picture for first and second sound in these Fermi gases. Now this is, let's say, this is a tube which carries the superfluid at a finite temperature. And the little N's and S, I also adapted from this Donnelly article in Physics Today. It just means there is a mixture of a normal component and a superfluid component, and the mixing ratio is just controlled by the temperature. The temperature is related to the superfluid fraction. So if it's T equals zero, everything is superfluid. And then, I mean, the superfluid part decreases. And then now, with the theoretical framework, I mentioned already Landau, and following the ideas also of Tisza. And now, what is now first sound? Very easy. You just exert some pressure, and you increase the density of normal and superfluid in the same way, so that the mixing ratio stays constant. And then this starts to propagate with a certain speed, and you detect somehow this propagation of this pressure wave, this adiabatic pressure wave, and this is what we call ordinary or first sound in the superfluids. Second sound means you have a different excitation scheme. You have to introduce some heating, so a little fire here, which heats up the sample in such a way that the superfluid is decreased. There's still a little S left, so it's not yet at the critical temperature, and there's more normal part. Then you find that this kind of perturbation also propagates like a wave in this way, but you find it's typically slower by a factor of 3, roughly. Yeah? It's slower, and this is now the second sound-like propagation of a temperature or entropy wave here. So that's the very simple picture of first and second sound. And now you have seen this before, and it's just want to make the point in liquid helium, it's relatively easy to do it. You just need a local heater, which can be just a wire, and you run a current through it. It heats the sample up locally, and you need some kind of detection scheme, which could be, for example, the evaporation signal then at the surface when this temperature wave reaches the surface. You also see these in the Alfred Leitner movies, how do you, I mean, the change distance from excitation to detector, and then, I mean, the time signal on the oscilloscope there changes. So this is quite of relatively simple there. But we have different systems, and our systems look schematically like this. So we have an infrared laser beam, and this infrared laser beam traps in a conservative optical dipole potential, traps an elliptically shaped, so it's a highly elongated cigar-like shape of lithium-6 gas, which is in two spin components. And these two spin components strongly interact via S-waves, because we have an S-wave, we have a Feshbach resonance there, which allows us just to, by changing the magnetic field, tune the interactions. And so the all what I'm going to talk about was made just right on top of this resonance, which is now very, very well known, and you can address this point very accurately. So that means the S-wave scattering diverges when you have the maximum interaction that quantum mechanics allows. Okay, so many experiments have already been carried out on these systems, and the whole story started about 10 years ago, so we celebrate the 10th anniversary of molecular Bose-Einstein condensation and strongly interacting Fermi gases, many experiments on BEC-BCS crossover physics. I mean, carried out in Innsbruck, but I mean, also very pioneering work made in Christoph Salomon's group. They are the first strongly interacting gas on these things. So it's many, many things have been done. And so there's some, it's a little bit strange. So many aspects of also superfluidity have been demonstrated in this system, but why not second sound so far? It took quite long. And I think there is a relatively simple answer to this. In this system, it's not so easy how to locally heat it up and how to then detect these propagating heat pulses. It's not obvious how to do this. And we thought about very complicated things. At the end, it turns out to be quite simple, but you will see. And so one little point I want to make is the axial confinement is not given by the optical trap. It's a magnetic confinement, and it has the advantage that it's perfectly harmonic, and we know the trap frequency on the almost 10 to the minus 4 level. So this is very, very important for the interpretation of the results, that we have this axial trapping scheme. But now, how to detect sound propagation? Classical experiment, 1997, Catalyst group. So they have a Bose-Einstein condensate. And what you do is you just apply a little local perturbation, like this potential peak here. It's just a repulsive laser beam. And if you apply it suddenly, then a bump arises in the quantum gas. And this bump then splits and propagates in both directions here in the gas. You can, alternatively, you don't need to create a bump. You can create a dip. It doesn't matter, really. If the perturbation is small and you see this dip propagating, you have this choice. And in this way, they detected these axial profiles where you see the propagating bump actually in both directions, and they could measure the sound speed in a Bose-Einstein condensate. The same kind of experiment was repeated 10 years later by John Thomas' group at Duke University in North Carolina. They did the same thing with a Fermi gas, with a strongly interacting Fermi gas, and you see that here. And you see they create a kind of strong perturbation, a massive dip, which is more than 50% of the maximum height, and then they see how this dip splits into two dips and then propagates into the outer region of the trap. And this, but it also, I mean, this is such a massive perturbation that it also creates some nonlinear effects, and it's not easy to interpret it quantitatively. Okay, so now we start by just doing exactly the same. So there's nothing new. We just adopt the scheme. The only thing is we have a much more sensitive detection scheme, and we can restrict our perturbation just to a few percent, so that it's really a small signal perturbation. And then we get this signal. Okay, first of all, this sketch shows this is the optically confined, strongly interacting Fermi gas, and the lighter region is the part where we have the non-superfluid but still strongly hydrodynamic part, and here is the superfluid part. One point I want to make in the strongly interacting Fermi gases, so also the classical part, the normal part, is very deeply hydrodynamic because of this enormously large collisional cross-section. This is something which you normally don't have with Bose-Einstein condensates, where most cases the non-condensed part does not follow hydrodynamic behavior, but we have it here. So the inner part is the superfluid part. Okay, and then you see these, now this is the axial position, the center of the trap, and this is just time, and the color code shows you the density difference. So it's a differential picture, so the picture without perturbation is just the profile is subtracted. So then you see, so this is the signal of the bump, which propagates to the right, which propagates to the left. You see it crosses this dashed line, and the dashed line is just the expected boundary of the superfluid. So it, without any problem, it penetrates into the region where there cannot be any superfluid. Okay, so this is the signal, and this is the first sound signal, same as detected before, but much more accurately. Okay, now a little change. So this is the picture I showed before, and this was done with the excitation beam, this repulsive excitation beam, just by turning it on abruptly. That's it. And now the trick is basically very simple. It's just a modification of this excitation scheme. It looks like this now. Now we keep it on. Okay, we start already in the evaporative cooling process. We have it on. And so it's now, and then at the, after the evaporative cooling, then we apply a burst of 6 wiggles somehow. And this creates heating. I explain in a minute why this, this makes up heating. And then we keep it on the beam. And that's important now because these are fast modulations. If I look into the time average of this repulsive potential, it stays constant. And therefore, the excitation of this ordinary sound signal is minimal. It's very small. But now these bursts here, this modulation, this is typically 3 or 4 times the radial trap frequency, but it's not very important. What it does, it drives the sample out of thermal equilibrium locally in a very fast way, and they are steadily going on some relaxation in the system, and this increases the entropy. So, and that's how we explain this. And then after such a heating scheme, so we observe a completely different picture. And here it is. Okay, now we see that we create in the center of the trap, we create a dip. So dark means there is a dip, and bright means there is some enhancement. So the missing atom have to go somewhere. So here is the dip. And this dip now propagates, you see it here nicely, but much slower than this signal. Propagates, slows down even further, and then you see it's disappearing right where we expect from the superfluid transition temperature, we expect the boundary between superfluid and normal. And it does not penetrate into this outer region. Now we have to analyze the signal, and we just plot now the center.
Just one question.
Yeah, sure.
So what is imaged here is density.
It's density, it's only density. So and you may ask, why do we have a density signal?
Yeah,
I come to back, I mean, this was actually exactly what you had at the end of your talk, some coupling effect. It's an important coupling effect. But now take it for a moment, just like that, that local heat pulse, it appears as a dip. Okay, it's a small dip, it's just a -2 or 3% signal in our excitation conditions. Okay, therefore the signal is quite noisy. It's a small signal that we extract. Okay, and now we analyze the position of the first signal, okay, which we know as ordinary sound, and here's the second signal versus time, position versus time. Now we have some noisy data. So these are fits, so this is just a polynomial fit. Now we want to get out the velocity. We have to take the derivative, which is sometimes difficult with noisy data, but we can take the derivative of the fit curves, and then we get these solid lines here. So sound speed versus time for the two signals. And the other ones, so these more noisy data, is some a different procedure. It's a more local fits to a group of data, and then taking the derivative just to get some feeling on the systematic deviations of things. And so these are now the extracted sound speeds versus time. So this is now purely experimental. There's no theoretical interpretation or nothing in it, just an experimental measurement of these speeds. But now we need theory to get deeper insight into that. And what can we learn from that now, the question? Now comes, I mean, our wonderful collaboration with the Trento group. I just want to introduce now our theory collaborators. I mean, certainly you know Sandro Stringari and Lev Pitayevsky and the graduate student Jan Hua working on that. And the experimental team, a small experimental team, the graduate student Leonid, and the postdoc Meng Kun. We had wonderful collaboration, meeting many times. I mean, driving to Trento or having them visiting us. So this was their visit in Innsbruck, actually, in January on the roof of our institute here, you see. Okay, so this is the team, and okay, this resulted in a publication in Nature on the second sound and the superfluid fraction. And you see that we have, a conceptual connection to Landau's work. But you also have a personal connection. I just want to show this slide from 1956, where you see the young Lev Pitayevsky in Landau's group. So Lev was really very much excited by this work, that some ideas that were around could now be realized in the experiment. So now from the Trento group, so I summarize this theory very quickly, just giving the basic ideas. So two important papers for us. And this is first, this one from 2010. And there they made the point, what happens in a cylindrically confined gas, which is very, very elongated. And then they showed you can reduce actually your basic equations to a one-dimensional version. So you say at radially, the situation is basically a thermal equilibrium. There's not much change, but the change is axially in the long axis of this cylinder. And they worked out the framework for these 1D thermodynamic equations, reduction to a 1D. It's not no one-dimensional physics, but it's just a one-dimensional wave equations for first and second sound. And then in the second paper, they applied this theory to an elongated trap where you also have a weak axial trapping potential. And the other thing, at that time, so the equation of state was available, and the equation of state of the fermions was measured in several different groups, also at ENS Paris. And the most recent measurement comes from Martin Zwierlein's group at MIT, and we used these measurements also to, knowing the equation of state and to work out now this thermodynamic framework for the trapped unitary fermigas. And so one thing, now coming to your question, is one thing that comes out is there is a small, well, not too small, there is a considerable thermal expansion. And that's what you see here. So this is in this one-dimensional framework close to the phase transition, though, that you see that the relative change in the temperature results also in a small change in the density, in particular if you are close to the transition point. So it's not a small effect. So 10% change in temperature means 5% change in density, 1D density, where you integrate out the transverse degree of freedom. And that actually makes these density of these temperature wave observable. But then you may ask, why can we still call it an entropy wave or something, or is it, it's a coupled situation, as you pointed out. But actually, so the Trento guys, they could show that it's a sufficiently strong coupling so that we can see the entropy wave as a little density variation, but it's still weak enough so that this simplified framework, which where the two parts decouple, still works very nicely, and corrections are below 1%. Yeah? And so it still keeps the character of second sound as being an entropy wave. Okay, so this is the point of quite large thermal expansion. So, and we know why it now becomes observable. This is something we did not expect before. It just came out by just trying in the experiments. And now I have to make to interpret this now. I have to discuss what is the relevant Fermi energy. And now let's consider a cylindrically confined situation, no confinement along the axis, but two-dimensional harmonic confinement. Then it's again a nice kind of student exercise to relate the Fermi energy in the sample, the Fermi energy to the one-dimensional density, the linear density of the system. Then you will find this kind of expression where the Fermi energy is related to N1, this linear density to the power of 2/5. So this holds then here for this kind of confinement. But now if you have a weak axial confinement, so then we see that the linear density changes very slowly, smoothly along the axis. And you look into some slice here, and you see there's no difference, basically. And that means now this N1 becomes C-dependent, and the same for the Fermi energy. So what we can introduce a slowly varying Fermi temperature for this situation. Now you may think, wow, that's a complication. Now it's getting really complicated. They have a varying Fermi temperature. but actually it turns out to be very, very nice and useful because it's illustrated here. Now it is an experimentally observed one-dimensional profile, and this is the, okay, now the point is now we have a varying Fermi temperature along the axis, but the whole sample is in thermal equilibrium apart from these little perturbations, so we can define a global temperature. It's characterized by global temperature. Now we want to express it in reduced quantities, so we introduce T over TF. And now you see this T over TF now varies along the z-direction, has lowest values in the center of the trap, where TF is highest, but then density decreases, TF decreases, and T over TF increases. And then you see, at this point, you reach conditions where the superfluid disappears, where the phase transition occurs. So actually now, looking at the cigar-shaped sample and watching the propagation along this cigar-shaped sample, we get information on the behavior for different T over TF. We get it for free here. We just have to analyze our data in this way. And then we get these results. Now this is the two sound speeds in reduced units. And so it's the speed over the Fermi speed. And this is the temperature over the relevant Fermi temperature. And then you see you have two signals. It is the first one, which we understand as ordinary sound. And I have to explain the lines. So this solid line actually comes from our experimental data, so this global fit. These are the more local fitting things, the points. So the shaded region shows our uncertainty range. And I have to explain the green dashed one. And the green dashed one is just what you expect from the equation of state. And you calculate what your sound speed is. So you see it fits permanently. So you can say it's a kind of independent test of the equation of state. It also shows that the 1D model works quite well. OK, but now we have the second signal. And the second signal, it shows this behavior. It's much slower. And then it gets even slower in the outer region of the trap and somewhere disappears in this shaded region. The shaded region is where the superfluid phase transition is located. So this is the error range, the uncertainty range of the phase transition. OK, and now we have these two signals. So first sound, excellent agreement with calculation based on the known equation of state. The other signal has a strong temperature dependence and goes to zero near TC. Okay, and now we ask Landau, and you find these equations you have seen before already. And Landau says that in this way, one of the speeds is almost constant, and the other one depends strongly on the temperature and goes to zero at the lambda point. So, and this is exactly what we see in the signal. Actually, here Landau also makes the point, maybe more subtle, that as you said, CP and CV sets equal. And in this way, then the equations completely decouple. This is not perfectly the case, but it's still an excellent approximation to put it that way. Okay, now these are the same equations, only in these with this reduced representation over the Fermi speed and for the one-dimensional system. So this gives some geometrical factors, but you find now some thermodynamic quantities which result from the equation of state, another one. So this is the first sound signal. And now the second sound signal, what does it contain? This is now a measured quantity. Temperature, this is also a measured quantity. And these are thermodynamic quantities which are known from the equation of state. You get it from the equation of state. But there's still something unknown. And this unknown here, the great unknown, is the superfluid fraction. So now we can turn things around and say from what we know and what we measure, we can determine this. That's what we do here. Now this is the superfluid fraction now that results from these measurements. And you see it starts to increase here, goes up to 60% at about 0.13 times the Fermi temperature. But still, this is the radially integrated quantity. It's not for the uniform system. It's the radial degrees are integrated out. But fortunately, it's possible also, I don't want to go into these details here, now to reconstruct the superfluid fraction for the homogeneous, the uniform gas, and then we get this. So then we can plot the superfluid fraction for the uniform situation versus T over TC. And here you see the experimental data. then we see two lines. So the dashed line is just, I mean, building on London's idea of this making a condensate. And this is a weakly interacting or non-interacting Bose condensate. And you see that behaves differently. But we know that, of course, it's a strongly interacting system. This weakly interacting theory cannot produce it rightly. But the green line here, actually, this is an experimental curve. It comes from experiments on liquid helium. And you see that the superfluid fraction is now quite close to liquid helium. That means if we are a factor 2 below the phase transition, it's practically 100% what you get as a superfluid fraction. And so then you may ask, why? So can you compare it to other available theories? But actually, there's not, for the superfluid fraction, there's not much on the market. Just found some papers. These are some summarized in a paper by Alan Griffin, few theoretical approaches on the superfluid fraction. It's a paper by Lukas Salasnic. But the problem is, so these theories, they get TC wrong. So, okay, now you can do some rescaling and rescale it to the right TC, then it follows approximately this behavior. But it's, I think it's not completely satisfying to have these rescaling things, so therefore we don't compare it to other theory approaches. There are other theories like quantum Monte Carlo calculation, they get TC right, but apparently they cannot get the superfluid fraction out. So point is now it's a difficult theoretical problem, and it's a very nice example for the flavor of our field. So we can measure now a many-body quantity which is by far not trivial, and it's a very hard problem for the theorists. And so we hope that we can stimulate more work on the theoretical side with measurements like this. Yes?
You get the Landau's formula for the normal density. So you get the superfluid density. And at low temperature, this is just related to elementary excitation. So this is sound waves and so on. And that, you know, sound waves. So at least, I guess, at low temperature.
Yes, at low temperature, I agree. At low temperature, there's more, yeah. It's, and this range, I think, it's quite well understood, as you say. But I mean, how it develops here, let's say for 50% of TC, and so this is not.
Just to elaborate more on Ron's comment, I mean, this region is particularly interesting, right? In helium, this would be the Rotem-dominated region.
Yeah.
So it raises a very interesting question, which is: there, can one get a sort of simple description of the elementary excitations or not?
Yeah. So it's. That's actually the point where I cannot tell you much more about this. That's the experimental facts. And but now as an outlook now of this part, it's so what can we do next? Yeah, of course, we can now revisit phenomena which are well known from liquid helium, like also transport to narrow channels and something like this. And I guess there will not be too many surprises with that. But maybe more exciting is to do new things. But now we, in principle, could study. Now we can now change our magnetic field and study the crossover physics of second sound. Another interesting topic, we could introduce controlled spin imbalance and see how this changes the second sound features. Or you can go to low D lattice physics and so on. This all could be done. We tried actually this summer to observe some second sound signal in the crossover. But then we had a major vacuum failure in the apparatus. And the apparatus is essentially dead. So we cannot continue directly with these measurements. But actually, we were lucky, very lucky, because already when we took the last measurements, we had signs of some problems in the apparatus. And we were very happy that we could finish this. OK, but we see how this will develop. But I think there are also other possibilities in new type of more exotic superfluids, making by, for example, by different constituents, like combining lithium-6 with potassium-40 or potassium-40 with something else like dysprosium. And I want to give you now some flavor of these new things. Okay, and now this is the end of this first part of the talk. And now I come to the new developments in Fermi gases. I want to show you this slide here. Okay, this is actually taken, I found in the web, somewhere in Tyrol, not very far from Innsbruck, in some valley. It's a barrier lake there. And you see already in this illustration that the barrier can really change things. So it separates two completely different regimes here. Okay. So now, why is this relevant for the Fermi gases? Let me look into a simple system, just a single component. Before, everything had two components, so they can interact via S waves. But now I have a single component Fermi gas. Let's say I take the erbium-167. And then I get the lowest channel is a P-wave channel for interactions, and I get this P-wave centrifugal barrier. And this dashed line is just a P-wave centrifugal barrier. And this here, now come molecular interactions, and the most long-range part is the van der Waals interaction. So this is just the van der Waals attraction combined with the P-wave centrifugal barrier. Then we know very well, look at the energy scale, it's given in microkelvin, that under typical conditions we have, let's say, a microkelvin, we are at very low energies, so that this interaction region is completely shielded. You don't see anything of it. And so that means interactions do not play a role. Everything is completely shielded. That's what we know from many experiments. Usually, when I teach laser cooling and quantum gas classes for the master students, I tell them everything is completely S-wave dominated, and you can forget about higher partial waves apart from a few exceptions. But now I think things are really different, and one has to change this. It's a change of a paradigm somehow. The question is anything interesting out there in this region? But the answer, only if you have some long-range interaction. Then you can have something interesting out there. In a long-range interaction, there are different ways to get it, and I want to present you two different ways. First one comes from this team. So the team is the erbium team, which is headed by Francesca Fellaino. She has an ERC grant on this and has an independent group in Innsbruck, and I'm just happy that I sometimes have the opportunity to collaborate. It's a very nice situation. I have no responsibilities for funding and everything, but sometimes I can scientifically discuss about that. And so it's now this picture again. So what makes it different now? Erbium has a magnetic moment of 7 times the Bohr magneton. And now we get a strong influence of the magnetic dipole-dipole interaction. And then the picture changes completely, then it looks like this. If the dipoles are parallel to each other like this, there's a strong repulsion, which increases the barrier. And if you have a head-to-tail configuration, the barrier is strongly reduced if the situation looks like this. And then you see far out there, okay, for the realistic energy scales that we have, there still you see the strong modification of the barrier. When you now go to the theory, and you find out, it was considered by several authors, but there's a very nice paper by John Bourne making these points, then you get a universal dipolar scattering. And the surprising thing is that even at very low, in the limit of zero collision energy, you get a finite cross-section, which is shown here for the even partial waves and for the odd partial waves, a finite cross-section at zero collision energy. And now we have fermions, we are interested in the fermions, so let's forget about the even partial waves. You know that this guy does not permit it then to have the interaction. And so we don't care about this in the fermions, but we care about that. And then you see, you get this universal cross-section. And this is the threshold value, is the cross-section is just 6.7 times the dipolar length squared. I will show the definition in a minute. And the dipolar length depends on the dipole moment and other quantities. For erbium, it is about 100 times the Bohr radius, following this definition. And this gives a cross-section which is 260 times the Bohr radius squared. And this is only 4 times smaller than people know from rubidium experiments. Let's say rubidium Bose-Einstein constant. It's only a factor of 4. It's a significant, a very strong cross-section. Now, can you use this cross-section for evaporative cooling of a single component gas? The answer is yes. You see it here. So this is the recent attainment. So this is a PIL, which will come out in a week. So this is the now the demonstration of Fermi degeneracy just by cooling of a single component sample. And we got in this paper down to 0.2 times the Fermi temperature. Now with some, after submission of the paper, of course there's strong competition in these things, but we could improve this. And now we get easily down to 0.1 T Fermi, which is really quite remarkable number. And you see now, if you look at the evaporation, this is just as an evaporation as a function of time. So we start at a little bit less than 10 microkelvin, and then it's cooled down over 15 seconds. And I have to say, what we need is a really tightly confining trap. The cross-section is relatively small, so we need just tight confinement. And if you look at this plot, just then you see so the T over TF versus N, then the expert eye sees that the slope is very important, and the slope gives the so-called evaporation efficiency, so how many orders of magnitude in particles you have to lose to get, I mean, how much is the gain in phase-space density you need for relative to the loss of particles, and we get 3.5, and this is a remarkably good number, 3.5. It's very points to very efficient evaporation. Now, devil's advocate. Devil's advocate is always my role in these things. I say, no, you have this, another spin component there, and you have S wave scattering, which makes all the evaporation. And then we have to check this, and actually it turns out we can artificially create now other spin states, populate them by radio frequency spin flips, but then we see that the other spin components, this is Stern-Gerlach picture, rapidly decay. And so we are sure that there's just a single spin component. And so devil's advocate has no chance there. Okay, so this is now the, so we are sure it's dipolar scattering. We can also measure the cross-section just by some thermal relaxation experiments, excite one direction and look into the thermal relaxation. In another direction, it's called cross-dimensional relaxation. And then you get the cross-section out, and you see these are the measured values in the non-degenerate regime, and you see the dashed line is just the theoretical value. So it fits very, very well. So we are sure about this dipolar scattering. Now, just a few numbers to impress you with the numbers. You are not impressed, I think, by the number of atoms, but if you look into the number density, the peak number density is in the 10 to the 14 regime, and this is unusually high for Fermi gases. Normally, they are in the lower 10 to the 13 regime. So it's really, we have a tightly confining trap. But then we tried to measure three-body loss. We could not. We could just get an upper limit. It's a very low value. And then you understand that evaporation is so efficient because you have a combination of high density, very little loss. But why is it so efficient? What is the physics behind this? What is the physics? Now I come back to this picture, because it gives you the explanation right away. The point is, all the nasty stuff, losses, I mean, this comes from coupling to more deeply bound molecular state, that happens here. This is what I call the lossy region. Okay, but we never get there, because we have this barrier. So we have our shielded, everything happens in this shielded region at an energy which is below the threshold, which is 7 microkelvin for erbium. So they never come close to each other, and they can never then decay here. So that's really very interesting. It's a very simple fact, but it works remarkably efficiently. Then you ask, what are the optimum conditions? So you see why I like this barrier picture. Yeah? And now you can ask about the optimum condition. Then you find, okay, for weakly dipolar fermions like potassium-40, the cross-section is way, way, way too small. For strongly interacting ones, for strong dipole moments like the dipolar molecules, you have a strong head-to-tail attraction, and this overcomes the centrifugal barrier, so this gets lossy. You need a compromise, and the optimum compromise is not chromium fermions, it's maybe not dysprosium fermions. Erbium offers fantastic values. It seems that it's just in the optimum region for doing that. So what next? So I think it's interesting to push it to the extremes. What is the limit? How far can we increase? I think maybe one order of magnitude in density is possible. And then you may ask the question, can we reach P-wave superfluidity? I know, I cannot give any answer, but we have to look into this more detail. But there are also other systems. Now, well, how about fermionic Feshbach molecules? If you have a strongly dipolar Feshbach molecule, a weakly bound molecule, normally they decay by vibrational quenching. But if the same mechanism works there, we still have a centrifugal barrier. We get elastic collisions and perhaps very little inelastic collisions. I think this is an interesting direction to go. And then you may also ask, are there n-body states, three-body states, or cluster states? Well, I don't have any answer to this, but it gives me at least a transition to the last part of the talk, and this is about three-body physics in the fermions. So this is now, we have two fermionic species, a heavy one and a light one. Okay, and this is the mass ratio. And then we know if we increase, normally there's a P-wave barrier in this system working, but for a critical mass ratio of 13.6, so this P-wave barrier is overcome by the three-body interaction here in this, by the mediated interaction. So this particle mediates an interaction between the identical ones, and then this overcomes the centrifugal barrier, and there's no more barrier present, and then you can get, again, Yefimov states, these three-body states with the universal scaling laws. Okay, but for lower mass ratio, you still get a centrifugal barrier. It's very small here, it's increasing. And you find there are other trimer states. So there's a Kartavtsev-Mallrich trimer, for example, for 8.2. But below this, really, there are no trimer states. So we are actually, this is what we do with the lithium-potassium system. We are somewhere here, 6.7 mass ratio. So there's no trimer state, but still the system feels the proximity of these trimer states somehow, and it's influenced by that. So we are interested actually in this regime of moderate mass ratios, where we still have a sufficient centrifugal barrier to protect you from nasty, lossy things. Okay, now what are we interested in? So our experiment looks into atom dimer scattering. So we produce a dimer, a bosonic dimer, by combining lithium-6 and potassium-40, weakly bound Feshbach molecule. And we let this collide with a potassium-40 atoms. Okay. So this is the collision process, and to understand the collision process, you can say when they come close to each other, it's essentially a three-body process. And these atom-dimer interactions have been investigated by, for example, by Jesper Levinson and Dima Petrov. I also learned that there is a paper on that by Roland Rombesco and co-workers, also looking into these atom-dimer scattering in the Fermi system. And now what is the physics now going on? And I think you get the idea, not the exact result, but the basic idea by looking into the von Oppenheimer type picture. And then you get, you have the two heavy ones, and then the light one, you look at the wave function, and it can be anti-symmetric or symmetric. And in the symmetric case, it acts kind of so the exchange effect, it's like a glue, and you get an attractive interaction. And in the anti-symmetric case, you get some repulsion. Okay. Now in our system, there's one more fact. You have to follow symmetry. And that actually at the end means for the atom-dimer scattering process, in even partial waves, the wave function of the glue particles, light particle, has to be anti-symmetric. So in even partial wave channels, you get a repulsion. And in odd partial wave channels, you get an attraction. Okay, now let me look into this for our system. So this is now a calculation for our specific system and the specific Feshbach resonance. I don't going to go into these details here. You see the dashed ones are just the centrifugal barriers. Of course, in the S wave, there's no centrifugal barrier. And with this interaction, you see strong repulsion in the S wave channel. But if you look into the blue lines, yeah, you see, this is only the centrifugal barrier, and this is together with the attractive interaction. And then you see on the realistic scale, so this is a scale, and this is a few hundred nanokelvin, then on the scale, energy scale of our experiment, there's still a strong modification of the barrier. So that it's very similar to what you have seen before for the dipolar system, only that the long-range interaction now comes from an exchange effect. Okay, and okay, even higher partial waves, so in the D wave channel, you get strong modifications. So already from this picture, you can expect that you have a strong atom-dimer attraction here in this P wave channel. Okay, so now, if you look into the theory in more details, that what Jesper and Dima did was you can look at the scattering amplitude, and then you see it is the scattering amplitude as a function of the collision energy. And then you see for the S waves, it's the dashed wave. S wave only is this dashed line. But if you include all higher partial waves, then you get a completely different behavior. So it's only at very, very low energies they correspond, and then higher partial waves become relevant, and you see it undergoes a sine change here and the attraction, and you have attraction here. So the most striking thing is you get a sign reversal. Okay, you can also plot it in a different way. If you change the magnetic detuning of the Feshbach resonance and keep the collision energy or the temperature constant, then you see S waves only, always repulsive. And close to resonance now here, the exchange in the attractive exchange interaction takes over, and you again see the sign reversal close to the Feshbach resonance. Now, this is something which is really unique to these asymmetric Fermi systems. You don't get it in the symmetric case. Okay, so actually it's interesting that the sign reversal occurs when you get the collision energy, which is roughly 10% of the molecular binding energy in the system. Okay, now here's the team. I mean, I mentioned our theory collaborators already and the experimental team here. I don't go through all the names, but actually I just want to say that Florian, who has joined me, actually he got his PhD here in Paris and then joined the Innsbruck group in 2004, end of 2004 or early 2005. I don't remember exactly, but now recently, just 2 weeks ago, he left for his new position in Amsterdam. We had a great time together. Okay, so now what is the experiment? Just a very simple illustration. So we have this mixture of heavy and light particles. We do what we call a Feshbach ramp. We use a Feshbach ramp for association of dimers, and with some additional cleaning pulses and so on, no details, we get dimers now and free potassium atoms. Okay, now we apply radio frequency to drive the potassium atoms into a different spin state. Okay, and this is yellow and it's the non-interacting spin state. So we can change the spin state of the potassium atom. One interacts very strongly with the atoms, the other spin state basically does not interact. So we do these radio frequency spin flips here. When we measure, then we get a spectrum in this way. So the transfer versus the frequency. And this is just the picture, the two different spin states driven of the potassium atom. And in the presence of the dimers, this gives rise to interaction effects in the spectrum. You will see a broadening and also a shift. And here is a typical spectrum. One thing we have to check, you look into this one here. This is over a larger scale. We have two signals, and this is when the radio frequency dissociates the dimers. But then there is the atomic peak. This addresses the free atoms, and we are interested in that part, the free atoms. And this you see on the magnified scale. You see two different curves, and that comes from either we drive from an interacting to a non-interacting state or the other way around. This gives similar signals, actually, same kind of line shifts and broadening, but also the outer region, the tails are a little bit different. But so we are interested in the shift and in the width of these signals. And now I show you the results. So this is width and shift for three different temperatures. You may look only into the central frame here. And you see what we changed is the magnetic detuning. Interaction gets stronger. And then you clearly see the sign reversal in the shift. So this is the region where the sign reversal happens. The same way we get a strong broadening effect. So this is something you can understand in a mean field-like picture. But this is also interesting. This tells you actually what kind of elastic collision rate you have. And already from analyzing these things, we can say we have around 100 elastic collisions for one inelastic collisions. And this is fantastic. Yeah, because all the other, this is the three-body effect, which has very little loss, but strongly elastic interaction. And the reason is, again, the same. We have the centrifugal barrier here. It's long-range physics. So now this is another plot to represent the data. Now it's versus scattering length, the S-wave scattering length. And this is just the real part of the scattering amplitude. And for very small values, this corresponds to the molecular scattering length. But then you see that higher partial waves take over. And with S waves alone, you would get the dashed lines. And now with the higher partial waves, it changes character, you get the sign reversal. And if you have strong interaction or close to strong interactions, then you have a considerable attraction instead of a repulsion. So that is really, I want to emphasize this again, an effect which is unique to these mass imbalanced mixtures. And of course, the interesting regime is for even stronger interaction. But we, in the first set of experiments, we just stayed in the regime where we could still interpret our data. And if you get closer, it really gets complicated because you can have collisional dissociation of the dimers and so on. And so here, collisional dissociation will set in. So here, it's a more complicated many-body regime. But we have evidence that interaction gets even stronger there in this regime, the attraction. So we are quite fascinated by this for a few reasons. One thing is we see that mass imbalance in the Fermi system creates new kind of physics, something which does not happen in the mass-balanced system. We see we have a few-body effect which has very little loss. And we have been studying these Yefimov-type physics for many years. But for many years, we have measuring loss curves. Loss curves. And at the end, you want to do something else. You want to have some maybe stable equilibrium system and investigate this. And I think these kind of, there's a few-body effect, I think, for the first time, which has strong influence on the physics, but which does not introduce losses. And then I think that's a kind of paradigm change now. I mean, what I told my students always in the master classes was S-waves only at these cold temperatures, but this is, I think, no longer true. We now have systems where really higher partial waves completely dominate the physics and are extremely important for what you see. And all these things together, I think, have the potential to make strong impact on many-body physics of such systems. So, and it's really intriguing now to think about how does this change really the many-body behavior. We have some preliminary experiments in the mixture, but it's not yet conclusive, but it seems to be very interesting. Okay, so now let me come to some conclusion. Let me show this periodic table again and just want to point to some new developments. Now I've shown only four fermionic species. I have deleted three ones. I have deleted the helium. It's a little bit difficult, I mean, to combine with other species and so on. The metastable helium. I have also taken out the strontium and the ytterbium, which are also very nice. But strontium and ytterbium, because they're closed shells, don't have the potential to get, broad Feshbach resonances. Something you want to have a controlled interaction tuning. So I think these are the species being of interest for studying physics of strong interactions in fermionic mixtures. And we have looked into the lithium-potassium combination and already seen some interesting physics. But there's a little drawback, so the system is kind of intrinsically lossy because the resonance that is we use for the interaction tuning is not in the lowest spin channel and there are some losses. But I think there are also other interesting combinations if you combine alkalis with lanthanoid atoms. And we are interested in this intermediate mass range. Of course, you can go lithium-6 and erbium, an interesting system for looking into Efimov states with relatively close spacing. But if you're looking into these moderately mass-imbalanced systems, I think combinations of potassium with either dysprosium or erbium are extremely interesting. And so we decided to set up, I mean, now we have a free lab space, and Florian left with all this strontium experiment. We think about a new experiment, and the choice is now to combine, actually, the potassium with dysprosium. Dysprosium, I mean, regarding the laser cooling and things like that, it's very similar to erbium, but it has two fermionic isotopes, and I think this is an advantage of the dysprosium. So I expect much more to come for these mixed Fermi systems. And I think with this I want to close, and thank you for your attention. And I just want to show you a new background slide. This is actually what I took when I came to Paris. I had a flight from Innsbruck to Vienna, and it was beautiful weather last Sunday. And I took this photo out of the airplane. It was somewhere in Austria. I don't know exactly. I have to find out where this was. Okay, so with this, I want to close. And again, thank you for your attention.